Hey, everybody. The Air Raid Podcast is now sponsored by the American Brewing Company in Edmonds, Washington. They're one of the fastest-growing microbreweries in the Northwest, featuring the extremely talented brewmaster Skip Madsen. His breakaway IPA has become their number one bestseller. Stop by and find out why. You will not be disappointed. American Brewing Company. Drink domestic. Buy American.
Ryan, crank up the heat! We're going to get this place hot and clammy. It's like the new boss like it.
Well, hello and welcome, everyone.
Oh, hey.
This is episode 60.
Woo!
In what has now become a long and drawn-out series.
It's gonna hurt a lot of it.
I am your host, Aaron Roden.
I don't know anything.
And of course, this is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Welcome, 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 welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. Thank you for downloading the show. We have got a fantastic show set up for you today. Seriously. Our guest today, Mr. John Roderick of the Long Winters, who will be joining us shortly, I had the best time talking with this guy. And he has got some great, great stories for us here that he's going to be sharing with you just about life in general and about his time in the music industry and all that good stuff. And we're going to be showcasing Long Winter's songs all the way throughout. So that'll be happening shortly. But first, of course, we got to get something big out of the way. Because I know you're thinking it. You heard that advertisement at the beginning of this show. What? What you say? The Air Raid Podcast has an actual sponsor? Yes, we do, as a matter of fact. Boom. Suck it. No, don't suck it. You guys are great. One of the reasons we have a sponsor is because people are actually listening to this show now. So, anyway, yeah, American Brewing Company here in Edmonds, Washington. They distribute here in the Puget Sound region, and that's about it right now. But if you go to their website and start checking them out, American Brewing Company, maybe we can get these guys to start distributing their beer elsewhere. And I'll tell you what, I went to a barbecue the other weekend. And they had a bunch of these beers there. The Blonde in particular is fantastic. I was blown away. Literally blown away by this beer. It was so good. So good. And I think you will enjoy it. So go and check them out. American Brewing Company in Edmonds, Washington. Okay. We have got a fantastic show for you. Many of you know... that I sometimes get on these little diet kicks and try my best to lose some pounds. And the most recent one that I went on was a little bit of a low carb. I was doing the low carb stuff for a little while because it really worked for me in college. Like I literally dropped like 50 pounds in college, which was amazing. I felt great. I was actually eating pretty healthy, although I wasn't eating a lot of breads, pastas, or anything like that. But I was also getting just a ton of exercise as well. So when I did it this last time, like I barely lost any weight because, I'm not really outgoing. Let's put it that way, right? I know I've talked about this many, many times, and you guys are probably sick of hearing about it. But anyway, so I was the other night, I was searching around the refrigerator for something sweet, and we were literally out of food. We had nothing left except for carrots, and nobody wants to eat carrots when they have a sugar craving. So I'm searching around the refrigerator and the freezer, and I happen upon this bag of chocolate that I didn't know existed in the refrigerator. And there's only like 5 pieces of chocolate. And I'm talking like the chocolates that are stuffed with things, you know, like gourmet chocolates, right? And so I start just tearing into these things. And by the time I get to the 5th one, it dawns on me, I remember where we got these chocolates. We got them at the supermarket when I was on my low-carb kick, and they were sugar-free chocolates. And the reason that there were 5 left is because they gave me really bad, really, really bad bowel movements.
No, Kelly Clarkson!
Yes. Kelly Clarkson, indeed. Oh, my God. And so there's something about this this sugar-free stuff that, and some of you might know where I'm coming from on this, but I think that, you know, the sugar-free stuff, it just literally runs straight through you and runs everything else straight through you as well if you eat enough of it. And I think it's like the what do they call it? Like the sugar alcohol, or it's like maltitol or something like that. But oh my God, dude, does it make you feel like crap. I mean, it tastes good, you know, especially when you're on a low carb thing, like, you know, eating that stuff, it's like your source of sweetness, right? But man, you eat one too many of those goddamn things and they will destroy your insides. And I mean, it starts with the okay, this is gross. This is getting gross. But you know, we're being real here. We're being real. I'm being upfront. I feel like we have a good relationship. I'm telling you about my life, and you know, this is what close friends do. This is exactly what close friends do. I tell you about my life, and maybe you send me an email and tell me about yours, about your experience with sugar-free candies, not emails. But yeah, yeah. So you can you know, email me, Aaron@air-raid.net. Anyway. So I get done with these, or I get down to the 5th chocolate, and it dawns on me what this is, and I'm like, oh, crap. Like, and with these chocolates, like, you can only eat one of them, and you're safe. You eat 2, you're done. You're totally done for the rest of the night. You're going to wake up at, like, 11:30 at night, or around 12, and you're going to be up for, like, 4 hours crapping your brains out and trying to hold in, you know, diarrhea farts. So I was thinking, oh, so Mairead had something really funny to say. She said, yeah, oh, you've got the number 3s. Yeah, I had the number 3s. It wasn't number 1. It wasn't number 2. It was number 3, man. I mean, it was bad. It was bad. God, what? Oof. This is gross. I hate starting a show off like this. I hate it. Anyway. Yeah, the number 3s. Remember that. Let's start this, because those things, those sugar-free candies that you always just like, you can't stop eating, especially when you're on a low-carb diet, you're like, oh, I can eat as many of these things as I want, because, you know, all the effective net carbs are really low. So here we go. You know, open the chute and just pour these little things in. And, oh, man, such a bad idea. Such a bad idea. Anyway, John Roderick, Long Winters, coming up next. We're going to go to our first musical break here. We're going to play Fire Island off of the Long Winters album, Putting the Days to Bed. This is an excellent song. And if you haven't heard it, I don't know why you haven't heard it. It's amazing. You should check out this band, longwinters.com. They've got a bunch of songs for free up on their website, and they're actually going to play a couple shows coming up soon here, and John Roderick here on the Air Raid podcast. What? I know. Calm down. It's gonna be fine. It's the Long Winters, Fire Island, more of the Air Raid podcast with John Roderick coming up next. See you in a moment.
asked me what I knew. They found my letter, and I don't have to wonder. No, I don't have to wonder. So I don't have to wonder. Did it reach you?
Here with Mr. John Roderick, avid tweeter, musician, songwriter, and writer.
Yeah, right. Although I think I would prefer you say those in reverse order.
So okay, so writer, songwriter,
right?
Wait.
No, let's start with songwriter.
Okay, songwriter,
writer,
avid tweeter.
Yeah, and there was one other in there, but I'm not going to stand on ceremony. Whatever it was, it couldn't have been that important.
Well, I just to get you on the show, I started following you because I'm new to the whole Twitter thing.
Oh, like welcome!
Thank you very much. It's always kind of it's struck me as an odd medium, you know, because you only get so many characters, whatever.
Right.
I've just started kind of getting on there, and I don't know what to do on there. But you seem to have. A good sense of what to tweet about.
Well, I think it's a common problem not to know what to do. It's such a blank slate.
Right.
That you get on there and you start following people and you either start trying to play games with them like, hey, I'm over here. Look at me. Follow me.
Right.
And nobody that's a grown-up wants to lower themselves to begging people to follow them. Right?
You see my face getting red right now? That's embarrassment.
Follow me. So you're on there and you're just...
Air Raid Net. Handle is Air Raid Net.
Follow me. You're on there and you're just tweeting into a void. You know, that's not fun to do either. So, yeah, it takes a while to find your feet. But I feel like it's just a writing medium like any other. And it can be very clicky on there. It's very...
How so?
Well, you get famous people on there, and they only are going to follow other famous people.
Right. Yeah.
And so you get these people that have 50,000 followers each, and they're talking back and forth to each other like, oh, hello, oh, hello, and You know, I was following Nico Case for a while and Ted Leo for a while.
Uh-huh.
And I like them both as artists, and I like them both personally. But they would tweet back and forth to each other 45 times a day. Like,
yeah.
What are you doing? I'm eating a sandwich. What are you doing? I'm wearing some clothes. And it was like, I don't, this isn't interesting to me. Maybe it's interesting to other people.
It's so, an exercise in futility.
Well, it's just, people use it different ways.
Right.
And I try not to fall into that trap because I have friends that are on there, and it's easy to feel like, oh, my friends, hello, I'm going to send you something that I should send you as an email or a text even.
Right,
like, we
right.
know each other. We can talk about this somewhere else.
Yeah. So which is basically how we communicated to get you here.
Well, you were tonight. you Facebook messaged me.
Oh, right.
First.
Okay. Yeah.
So
yeah.
just to cover all the just to cover right. all the social networking bases. But yeah, what I liked about Twitter right away was, you know, you have this 140 character limit.
Right.
But I really embraced that as a challenge. So all my tweets for the first year were all exactly 140 characters long.
Whoa.
I would sit and I would work on them and try and make these 140 character things. And if it was 138 characters and it was perfect, I would disassemble it and put it back together and make it 140. Because I wasn't going to use
Would you end up like spelling words wrong then? Or
No, that's the thing. I wouldn't use gratuitous punctuation. I wouldn't,
yeah, okay.
you know, I wouldn't, I tried not to even use contractions if I didn't have to.
Uh-huh.
And so I really enjoyed it. It was like a writing assignment. Can you make three or four little things that are funny, that are thoughtful, and
right,
that are
right.
exactly this long? And after a while,
it's almost like doing a haiku.
Yeah, that's
right?
exactly right.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
exactly what it is. And after a while, I was thinking in 140 characters. Like, I would sit down, I would write a thought that came to my mind, and it was 140 characters, and I would send it. It was like a kind of thing that you teach yourself to do. And then I realized that I needed to use some of that creative energy toward writing songs and writing other things besides tweets.
Well, because all your songs ended up being only 20 seconds long.
Well,
after
it's funny because that you would think that I would be able to mine all those tweets for all these great song lyrics,
right?
But
right.
there's such different mind spaces, you know. So
yeah.
I didn't get a lot of lyrics out of it.
Yeah. Well, you're very good at it.
Thank you.
You should be proud of this.
Thank
because
you.
I find it extremely hard. I don't think you know. I'm not a funny person. I'm funny in real life, maybe,
mm-hmm.
because I, you know, run into things and fall down sometimes, get hit with ladders.
Physical humor.
Yeah, yeah.
Slapstick.
Yes. But I don't know if I can, you know, that doesn't transfer well onto paper or computer screens.
Similarly, I can be funny on Twitter and in person, but I cannot write a funny song. And
no,
I have a lot of friends that write funny songs that are hilarious, and I admire them for that.
Like we talking like Weird Al Yankovic?
No, not
funny,
like
funny or just like introspective kind of.
Yeah, for instance, They Might Be Giants, who often get lumped in with Weird Al, but they're completely different.
Right.
And
right.
They Might Be Giants can write a song that's on the surface very humorous, and then you dig into it, and it's like extremely poignant and you know, and brilliant,
and still seems to get stuck in your head,
right? And also
yeah.
a super pop song. Or Jonathan Colton. I don't know if you're familiar with Jonathan, but
I'm not, and I meant to check that out because you recently have worked with him.
Yeah,
right?
And he is a tremendous songwriter and one that can do that same thing: write a funny song. On the surface, you think, oh, it's a song about zombies, and then you realize, no, it's a great song, a perfectly written song, and it happens to be about zombies.
Yeah.
But I can't write a funny song, or either I can't do it, or I'm not interested in it. Somehow, some fundamental way, I'm not interested.
Right.
In
right.
It.
Like, well, your brain just doesn't work that way, right?
Right. Exactly.
And it's like, and I found that, like, when I write songs, I haven't written a song in a long time, but it was either. You know, the music that I would write was either kind of in the Sonic Youth vein, or it was folk.
Right.
You know? And that I could never stray from that. Mm-hmm. Like, it just didn't work. I just couldn't do it. I can't get myself to do it. And when I try to do it, it just ends up sounding like, you know,
sure,
a contrived pop song.
Yeah, you feel inauthentic.
Like right, yeah. Right. Yeah, totally, totally. do you ever find that with songwriting?
Oh, absolutely.
When you're trying to do something that you're just not familiar with, or
well, on this record that I'm working on now, I'm trying to be more earnest.
Uh-huh.
Which isn't to say that I've been sarcastic before,
right?
But I've been, I think I've erred on the side of being obtuse, or of being hard to parse, maybe. And I'm trying to be more direct and more earnest, and it isn't coming naturally to me.
Yeah.
Because I wince at emotion that's directly expressed. You know, I always couch it in a metaphor.
Okay.
And now I'm trying to just say, like, stuff right out on the table. And
yeah, yeah. But that's still, in some way, too, though, that's still being earnest, though.
Well, that's what I mean. The earnestness is a thing that I struggle with.
When you try to do it,
when I'm trying to be like absolutely speaking straightforward and
right,
without any verbal trickery,
uh-huh,
it's a struggle. And I mean, yeah. I know plenty of songwriters that do that only, and most of them I'm kind of like, man, it's a little emo,
yeah, yeah,
a little boring. I'm trying to do something else with it, and you know, I come from the, not the Bob Dylan school, but certainly I admire that style of like, what do those lyrics mean? They clearly mean something. I think my words work that way,
right,
more
right,
often than not.
Yeah, but Bob Dylan would say they mean nothing. Leave me alone.
Yeah, I know. Dylan and Kurt Cobain both said that.
Right.
You know,
I just
wrote those. They don't mean anything. Leave me alone.
Yeah, yeah.
And both of them are liars, of course.
Yeah.
They worked on those lyrics, and they.
It came from somewhere.
Well, yeah, they're great. They're not, it's not, you know, it's the same old, like, oh, this old thing, I just threw this on my way to the Grammy Awards. Sure you did. Sure, you just threw that sequin tuxedo on.
Yeah, with the peacock feathers over your breasts.
I read a thing the other day about Kurt Cobain that said some like mainstream journalist made the claim that Kurt Cobain didn't care about his lyrics and wrote them on the spot. I was like, Kurt used to say that in interviews 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
But for somebody to still be propagating that line of horseshit, I don't understand.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he published his freaking journals. It was clear that he was working on his songs.
Yeah, yeah. And they all come from somewhere, too. Even if it's like a nonsensical string of words, like in a Beck song, you know, I mean, it's gonna mean something to the writer, you know?
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Well, I mean, who knows about Beck?
maybe that was a bad comparison.
If you've ever tried to talk to Beck, it's like, geez. Yeah, maybe that is how his mind works.
Wait, have you met him before?
Well, I wouldn't call it that, no.
No?
No. I've stood on his stage, on the side of his stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, pat words in passing.
Okay.
But not, he and I didn't sit in like, share our deep thoughts, but I know people who have worked with him, and
uh-huh,
and he's not.
Is he a weirdo?
Well, who, I mean, anybody that gets famous when they're 22, I think, is a weirdo. Full stop.
Yeah, yeah,
full
totally.
Stop. Show me one rock star that was famous at 22 that's a normal person now.
Right, right.
And I'll put in with you.
Exactly. So let's switch gears here for a second. You recently, like I, have become a new father.
Mm-hmm.
You got a 5-month-old
mm-hmm
daughter,
mm-hmm,
correct?
Mm-hmm.
And how is that going for you, sir?
It's great. It's wonderful. I'm sorry, I put my glass down on the table and it sounded like I dropped a rock into a cave.
Yeah, boom. it's this arm right here.
All right,
suspension. The springs make a lot of noise.
Being a father is great. I've always wanted to be a father, and I am one now, and it's just exactly as I imagined it.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, Yeah, it is. It's there are a lot of people that want to make it into a lot of things that it isn't. You know, there half the people I talk to talk about being a parent like it was the end of their life.
Right. Right.
And the beginning of some new life where they were a slave to a to a little bug.
Yeah.
To a little like spitting up pooping bug. And then the other half of the people talk about it like it's some kind of spiritual transformation where they were completely remade and now are living always in the light, floating on a cloud.
Right.
Through the agency of this like miracle baby.
Yeah.
Who's the greatest thing that's ever happened.
Right. And who is better than your baby?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And neither of those experiences, I mean, they never sounded like they had any grounding in reality. And
my firsthand experience is that,
right, those people were bullshit before they had a kid.
Yeah, and they're still bullshit.
They're
now.
Bullshit now. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And that's it's funny you say that, too, because I was having a conversation with a woman a couple weeks ago who asked how my little parasite was doing. and she's a mother of three.
Oh, yeah.
And so...
Well, she should know.
Yeah, right, right. And I was like, excuse me? A parasite? Like, I was just like kind of... I know her well. And,
yeah.
And I was taken aback by her choice of words there. Mm. And she was like, well, that's, you know, that's what it is. It's, you know, it feeds off you and stuff and takes your calories and... And I was like, oh, like, you know, like a butt worm,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it's funny because there are a lot of people out there that are just like, yeah, my life ended.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then all of our, you know, we were kind of the first one in our group of friends to finally have a child.
Uh-huh.
And they were very worried leading up to it.
Yeah.
Because they all share that feeling that your life is going to end.
Right.
Once
they're worried they're going to lose you guys.
Right, right. Yeah. But in fact, they haven't called us in years, so it's no skin off their back.
Well, I've definitely found that whatever it was, whatever aspects of my old life that I have sacrificed in the last five months because I have a baby are not, I don't even remember what they were.
Right,
right. Like,
right.
What did I stop doing again? Oh, right, spending that extra 4 hours hanging out with ding-dongs at Beth's Cafe at
right.
4 o'clock in the morning, like eating an extra stack of pancakes with some...
Yeah, or a 12-egg omelet.
Yeah, right, exactly. With some shitbirds that I wouldn't hang out with under any other circumstances, except we were all standing around outside of the Sunset Tavern, and it's like, what are we going to do now? I don't know. And now, you know, at the end of the night, I'm like, good night. See you later.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I don't... There's not, I don't feel any... I'm more than paid... In full by the experience I get when I get home.
And oh, totally.
There's a little bug there.
Yeah, I've gotten to the point now when I get home now, and our baby, our daughter, whose name is Tatum, is here. She lights up when I come home, and she's all smiles and stuff. She's finally recognizing me, you know, and smiling a lot, and that's just a God. What a great feeling.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even if she's just if it's some genetic mandate and,
right.
and
yeah.
you're just
or
an
she's
assemblage
just got
of
tons
colors.
Of gas.
You know? Right. Even so, the smile still is it's worth waiting all day.
Right, for. Right. So what do I have to look forward to? You're a couple months ahead of me here.
Well, they just get more and more sentient all the time, right?
Right.
So
right.
So you get these things where they start, you know, they start being aware of their hands. And they're kind of punching themselves accidentally, and and then you watch them just gain control over these things, and they start to have more agency, they're more capable, and it happens both gradually and suddenly. I mean, I'm only 5 months in, so who knows?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
we may have to revisit this in maybe a couple years.
Right. When they're both 14.
Right, right. Yeah. And then we can come back and we can both say, well, we were both totally wrong. The guys that were saying my life was over were totally right. Because this sucks.
Yeah.
Because we have daughters.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, I'm not worried about it. I mean, whatever
I
aspect.
Am,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Whatever aspect about of having a girl that is terrifying to us as dads, I think it's going to be much more. I'm so looking forward to the first teenage boy that shows up at my door, trying to take my daughter.
Do you own a shotgun?
To an event? Do I? My house.
I have 12 of
my
them.
House is a freaking armory, and I'm gonna be sitting there. I'm gonna have a broadsword and I'm gonna be sharpening it on a whetstone. I'm gonna be dressed head to toe in like Civil War reenactment costume.
Oh, wonderful!
With like a medieval sort of helmet.
And
I'm going to speak to him in Esperanto. Boys are going to run from my. I don't care.
Please tell me you're going to be smoking one of those little like what do they call them? The little backwoods or blackwood. Oh,
no, I think like I'll be smoking a 3 foot tall graphics bong with apple scented tobacco in it.
That sounds like a plan, man.
Yeah,
that sounds like a plan.
Oh yeah, I've got it all worked out.
Yeah. One thing. Okay, so this is one thing that I failed to ask Ben Hooker of Visqueen when he and Rachel Flotard were on a couple weeks ago. Is that, are you ever worried that your kid is not going to think you're cool?
Oh, right. Well, Ben Hooker doesn't have anything to worry about because he's an extremely cool man.
Right, right.
In my case, coolness has never been a... Coolness is not a factor for me, or it's not an operating, principle. I just hope that my daughter and all of her friends are terrified of me and that all the other parents of my daughter's friends are terrified of me and that her teachers are terrified of me and that basically everybody that I meet from here on out, including you, I hope is terrified of me.
I am totally terrified.
So cool is like so far down the list of things I'm worried about.
Well, that is a great spot to, you should tweet that. Actually,
I probably have.
You probably have, yeah. It's been done. This is a great spot to go to our second musical break here. And I was thinking that we would play something that I have written down.
Nicely done.
At some point. Yeah.
Super.
You can see how prepared I am for everything here. We're going to go with the song Stupid by John Roderick and the Long Winters. Of course, they're called the Long Winters. They're not called John Roderick and the Long Winters. They're not playing Dave Matthews Band covers.
Right. Although, you never know.
You never know.
For the next record, it might be John Roderick and his Long Winters play Dave Matthews Band
eight
covers.
Eight versions of Satellite. Okay. We'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast. Like it's the simplest thing for me to be there. You tell me no, that I'm a fool to go calling her and calling her. You can call me stupid when she tells me it has to end. Stupid, you could call it that. Stupid, but you have no idea how stupid I would feel. All right, we are back with John Roderick. That was Stupid by the Long Winters. And when we left, we were kind of talking about being dads and if we're going to be cool.
Right. Well, that, yeah.
And my plan is
to... Let me just say right now that talking about being a dad is already super uncool.
Totally uncool. Right.
Three quarters of your listeners are rolling their eyes right now at you.
Actually, we've got more listeners since I became a dad, so untrue, sir.
All right. It's a bunch of guys in yoga pants out there really like, yeah, go dads.
Yeah, good job, Aaron, you idiot. But my plan, and I tell everybody that has children that comes here, is my plan is my daughter is going to be a really cool chick drummer.
Oh, that is a great idea.
Isn't that that's a good idea? Do you want to steal that? Or bass player? Your daughter could be a bass player.
Well, if they start as a drummer, then they can go anywhere. I mean,
that's true.
They can. Yeah. They should then learn the bass and then be one of those people.
Because they have rhythm. Everything. They have rhythm down.
Have you researched Lenny Kravitz's drummer, whose name is Blackman? What's her first name?
I have no idea. I try to steer away from everything Lenny Kravitz.
Well,
no offense.
And rightfully so, except his drummer is a super duper badass, and she just married this is like two strikes, right? She just married Carlos Santana. So it's like, come on, lady. Seriously.
What are you doing with your life?
But she's an amazing musician, and anytime, I mean, the only way that I managed to get through the 90s because Lenny Kravitz was everywhere. Was that I would just watch his drummer and try and tune out the rest of the music. Just watch the drummer, and she's incredible. She should be she's a national hero, I think, as a musician.
I'm going to have to – has she been the drummer since like day one or something? Or
she didn't play on the Let Love Rule era.
Which one was that?
That was the good Lenny Kravitz, the first record. The first Lenny Kravitz record was amazing. Let me just go on record
that
and
was
say.
The one with what's the
– Mr. Cab Driver.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
That was
the good one.
Perfect stuff. She came in a little bit later, but it's not her fault that the music is...
No, she didn't write the song.
No, she just plays the kick-ass part.
Yeah. My experience with Lenny Kravitz was during high school, I was a lifeguard, and we had this big PA system set up, and they would just play whatever the pop station was in Seattle at the time.
Yeah.
And that song, like, I wish that I could fly, you know,
like a butterfly, so right? High it's up like in the sky.
Another word that rhymes with fly.
Yeah.
But so that song, like you would listen to the whole rotation on that station.
Oh, you'd hear it three
over
times an hour,
and
right?
Over and over and over again. And it was just ridiculous. And it was like, they didn't even mix it up at all. You know, they didn't even put the songs in different spots.
Right.
It was just like, okay, well, there's Matchbox 20, and now is going to be Lenny Kravitz's song that comes on.
I think Santana was probably in that rotation.
And Santana was probably in that rotation during that year.
Yep.
Yeah, totally. So, hey, let's talk about you for a little bit.
All right.
You like that segue?
I love talking about myself, like any musician does, like any artist.
The whole point of having you here was to talk about your life.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I was doing a little reading up on your Wikipedia page.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. I think it might be full of lies.
Most of it is wrong, but it did say that you were born here in Seattle and moved up to Alaska.
Right.
Right. So, how long did you live here before you moved up, to the AK?
Well, I was born. When I was born, my folks lived in Kingston, Washington.
Oh, that's where I'm from.
Kitsap County?
Kitsap County, buddy.
You're from Kingston?
Or well, I'm from Indianola.
Oh, sure. All right. Yeah. Just up the road.
Yeah.
So we lived in Kingston. And then...
Home of Chris Cornell, by the way.
That's right. All those guys are from over there.
Yeah. Bummed my first cigarette off of Kim Thiel.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the John Goodmanson, the Seattle producer, the famous producer, also from Kitsap County.
No shit.
Has a lot of great stories about those guys. Ben Shepherd and the Shepherd brothers.
Yeah.
Living out on Kitsap and getting into fights with Navy guys. So we lived out there, and I was spared being a member of that grunge generation by the fact that my father moved us to Alaska when I was two.
How come?
He wanted to start a bank. In fact, he did start a bank. He started a bank here in Washington, and then he started a bank in Alaska because it was the Wild West back then. It was the And both banks, I think they both survived, but they were wrested from him by unscrupulous men. That's his version of the story. Yeah, unscrupulous men stole the banks from him. So we lived in Alaska there until I was four, and then my folks got divorced. My mom moved back to Washington, and I split my time between Seattle and Washington until I was in fourth grade. And then I
Seattle and Alaska. Yeah.
And then I went to live permanently with my dad when I was in fourth grade.
Really?
And then was there until high school ended.
Yeah.
Until I graduated.
Do you remember a lot from that time? Was it hard on you?
Growing up in Alaska or the...
Well, just doing like the... I mean, that's it. That's a huge trip.
Yeah, but that was the 70s, right? So one parent would take me to the airport and there was no security at the airport.
Right, right. And you could fly by yourself.
Right. So they would walk me up to the gate. Uh-huh. They would hand me off to a stewardess. Then the stewardess would take me on the plane, sit me in the chair, and spend the whole flight bringing me crayons and whatever else, little wings, cookies, crackers, whatever. And then the plane would land, and hopefully, if everything went according to plan, there would be another parent at the other side. It didn't always happen, but most of the time it did. But I got very resourceful. I got so I could take the bus, and I was a pretty resourceful little guy by the time I was in third grade. So I mean, it was a typical American upbringing.
Yeah,
I mean, I know a lot of people whose parents are still married happily after 40 years, but I know a lot of people whose parents aren't.
Right.
And
right.
I was in that category.
Yeah. Was it an amicable breakup with your parents?
No.
Was it messy?
Yeah, but I mean, this was like I say, the 70s before people had the mental technology to get divorced without fighting.
Right.
I mean, that came later when...
Well, I think it's more fighting now because people sue each other for more.
Well, they did that then, too.
Yeah.
I think now everybody has been to a psychologist, right? Like when you're a little kid in school, there's a psychologist at your school. You're talking to fucking psychologists everywhere you go. And so very few people manage to make it to adulthood without having some concept that psychology might be at play, at least.
Right, right.
But in the 60s and 70s, I think like college-educated adults were, you know, had all been to see a psychiatrist, maybe.
Yeah.
But it wasn't so clear that you would practice those principles in your daily affairs.
Right.
So I think people just much more were like, "Damn you to hell!" I don't know. Who knows? Yeah. I haven't been divorced, and the people I know that are getting divorced, they're not getting along either. So
yeah. You know. So not much has changed.
Yeah, people suck, and love is no fun. Avoid it if you can.
Are you married?
No.
Together with the mother of your child.
The child's mother and I live together in a house with the baby.
Gotcha. Enough said. So when did you permanently move back down to Seattle then?
Well, I left Alaska 10 days after I graduated from high school.
Okay.
That was in the era when you could buy a one-way ticket from Anchorage to Seattle for $99.
Man.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So I bought a $99 ticket and I flew to Seattle and I stuck out my thumb. I was 17 and I wanted to see America. I stuck out my thumb and hitchhiked around for a long time, and then I figured out that you could jump on freight trains.
Yeah,
that was the very end of the era when boxcars were still a big part of freight trains.
Right, right.
Before the trains, you know, before it moved into container shipping entirely. So
So would you like normally like run into other people doing the same thing, or?
Well, it's interesting. This was the mid '80s. I graduated from high school in 1986,
mm-hmm.
and the hobos, the true hobos,
yeah,
were a dying breed, right? These guys were the ones that were left were old.
Yeah, yeah.
And there wasn't really a new breed taking over, right? Jumping freight trains was not like wasn't a chic thing for young dudes.
Yeah.
So I did meet a lot of guys, but they were all old creeps.
Uh-huh.
I think that there were old creeps, and then there was a migrant farm worker community that used the trains.
Right.
But they weren't hopping trains for romantic reasons.
Yeah, they were hopping to get from job to job.
Yeah, they were doing it like they did in the 30s.
Right.
The people who were riding freights because that was all they knew anymore, the ones who didn't have social security numbers that were like off the grid.
Right.
Those guys were all pretty road worn by that point. And I was the youngest.
I can imagine.
Youngest person I saw on a.
And this at the age of 17?
Yeah.
17.
Did
you have a little like stick with a.
I thought about
it. On the end of it?
No, I actually had a little backpack that my dad bought me at the Smithsonian Institution. but I, you know, I was from Alaska, so I didn't have a very good. I mean, Alaska is part of America, but it's also a foreign country in a way.
Right, right.
And yeah. So I had, in some ways, I was much, I maybe was a little bit tougher. Than a normal sort of American kid, it's just a little tougher up there.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I was incredibly naive because Alaska is a closed system.
Uh-huh.
So it sort of propagates a naivete. Like you feel in Alaska, you feel like nature is trying to kill you at all times.
Right.
But that if you follow a few simple rules, then everything's golden.
Yeah.
And
the town drunk is just Terry, and he'll make it home at some point.
Right.
But when you get onto the, and you meet another Terry or somebody like Terry on a railroad car, you should probably keep your distance.
The game changes a little, yeah. And I had the experience very definitely of being 21 or 22. And I still occasionally would ride trains in the years after that big year.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a moment where I suddenly realized what peril I had been in the whole time, because I would show up in these hobo camps, and I'm 17. I got a peach fuzz mustache.
Yeah,
my skin is like this pink, unblemished, you know, the color of like perfectly done pork. I would roll into these.
That's a good descriptor.
I'd roll into these camps, and I there'd be a fire burning. It'd be 1 o'clock in the morning. I'd see the fire off in the trees. You know, I'd be like, "Oh, there's some dudes."
Yeah.
And I'd go tromp in, and I'd say, "Hey, fellas," you know, and these guys would, you know, crane their necks around and like, "Who is this kid?" Like,
and what
whoa.
Is he doing here? Yeah.
And they would immediately start to kind of paw at me, and each guy would kind of say, "Hey, kid, you know, here, come sit over here by me. I'll tell you how it's gonna be. And let me, you want some beans? I got some beans over here."
Trying to assess what you got and what you have on you,
and as a group, they were kind of circling and trying to get a sense of like, and you know, these guys are not jumping the trains and living out in the brush because they're super nice dudes who fell on some hard times.
Right, right.
Like, these guys are rapists, and they're bad men, you know? They were pushed out of the world mm-hmm. for some reason.
So did anything kind of...
Well, that's the thing.
Happen?
My good fortune
was
that at 17 years old, I was 6'3" and 220 pounds. And I had this naive confidence of a kid who thought that all he had to do was make sure that he didn't freeze to death, right, and everything else was taken care of.
Yeah.
So I'd roll into these camps, and I could, I mean, looking back, at the time I wasn't conscious of it, but looking back, I realized that these guys were thinking, is he a cop? Is he,
right, right,
is he a psycho? Like, is he a kid that's coming out here and there are a bunch of his buddies out in the trees and,
yeah,
the, and it's, and we're in trouble, you know? So,
well, that's how you have to play it, dude. That's how you have to play it. Like, you just cover yourself in like pig blood.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just leave a very large stain of blood somewhere on your person.
But that's the thing. And then, if I had been conscious of that and had, yeah, been trying to play it off like that.
Right, right. Then you wouldn't have, they wouldn't have believed
it. They would have seen right through, right, me, right, and I probably, yeah, would have been gang raped and thrown in a bush, you know?
You know. But, well, to each his own. I mean, you know, some people like that. Whatever.
Anyway, so I made it through that whole period, and I did it just by the grace of pure dumb luck and pure, yeah, stupidity. But, yeah, I rode trains all across the country.
Wow, wow.
And
when did you finally pick up a guitar and realize that was something that you were going to be good at? Well, or that you wanted to do?
I'm not sure. I'm still not sure if I'm good at it. But because I went to school in the 80s, right, that every guy in my high school picked up a guitar.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so you started in high school?
Well, every guy in my high school was a better guitar player than I was.
Right.
Everyone. When I was a senior, there were freshmen that were 1,000 times better guitar players than I was.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
I was the one that that wasn't embarrassed to sing.
Mm.
And most high school boys are, like, embarrassed to sing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
So that was the big era of metal, and everybody was a great metal guitar player, and I was kind of the default singer in a couple of bands.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until later, I was probably 24, before I, you know, was sitting there, had a guitar in my hands, had written a few songs, had written enough songs that I could sit and play for 20 minutes for a couple of friends. And I, you know, played in somebody's apartment one time, and my friend said, "Oh, you should have a band."
Yeah.
And that was the first time it occurred to me that was something you could do as an adult.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at 24, I wasn't much of an adult, but.
And you were here in Seattle at that point?
Yeah. I was here by then.
Yeah.
And the grunge thing was happening, and I was working in the rock clubs.
Uh-huh.
I worked at, the Off Ramp during that era.
Oh, yeah.
And, I started as the bus boy, and then I was the cook. Uh-huh. So this is, I started there in January of 1991. Yeah.
Now the off ramp became Graceland, yeah, which is now El Corazon.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But the Off Ramp, I mean, they filmed a couple of scenes for singles there.
That, oh, yeah, was where, yeah, totally,
Pearl Jam started there, you know, started playing shows, and then I ended up being the assistant manager by the summer of that year.
Mm-hmm.
So I was right in the heart of the grunge thing, and I didn't really identify with it. I had never identified with punk rock very much.
Yeah.
The grunge stuff, I didn't identify with it. I mean, I liked it when it sounded like Black Sabbath.
Uh-huh.
I didn't like it when it sounded like Skinny Puppy or whatever, you know.
Right,
But little by little, I kind of started writing songs on the side, and they always came out the same way. They were always, it was always what we would call indie rock now.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just in 1992, that wasn't a very fashionable vernacular.
Right, right.
So I was.
Was there any place to, like, any venue to do besides, like, you know, open mics or something like that?
No, that's exactly what it was. Open mics and,
yeah,
and little, it's all the little shitty clubs, and some of,
right,
them are,
right,
the same shitty clubs that are. Actually, there aren't that many of the same shitty clubs. I mean, back then.
Well, thank God they finally took the rock candy out 10 years ago, or however long, because that place was a shitty club.
There were a lot of shitty clubs. I mean, the Storeroom was a place that you could always get a show. The Lake Union Pub, you could always get a show at these places that smelled like bleach and piss and,
right,
and vomit.
Yeah.
But that's what you have to do. I mean, that's what everybody has to,
yeah,
do.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the time, the grunge dinosaurs still, like, roamed the city all the way into the mid to late 90s.
Right, yeah.
and the indie rock thing was just kind of burbling underneath.
Yeah.
Built to Spill, obviously, was doing their thing, and they were like gods to us.
Yeah.
Because what they were doing wasn't grunge or wasn't in, even uh-huh. informed by grunge.
Yeah.
But as far as the rest of the city, no, it was all little piddly shows.
Yeah, yeah. And who are you? Who are you? What was your first band's name there?
Oh. The first band was called 3 Hour Shower.
Uh-huh.
And then that morphed into the Bun Family Players. Oh no! Even before that, I had a band called Chautauqua. You can see that these were not. I mean, at the time, most bands in Seattle were called like Grunt.
Yeah, yeah, Grunt Truck.
Well, Grunt Truck was a great band, but but there were, you know, bands were just called Spew,
Gas Huffer,
Gurf, and Narg, you know. And there was one guy in my band that always coming to me like, "Oh, dude, we should call our band Gnar."
Gnar, yeah.
And
after the Norse god.
Yeah. We ended up being the Bun Family Players, much to his consternation. But that was the time, and
yeah, yeah.
You know, you wanted to. Nobody knew what was coming next, and
yeah.
And in a way, like what was considered cool was that you didn't try and be hip, and that turned into its own kind of hip later. But
yeah, and you don't even talk about it, and you can't do anything.
Yeah.
You don't look people in the eye.
Yeah, it was kind of a black time for that type of stuff.
Right.
There was a lot of really pretentious stuff that went along with that reaction to grunge and to fame.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
And I think a lot of that has kind of just dissipated. And partly it's because all of the famous indie rock bands ended up doing like Coca-Cola commercials, and they had to ratchet their rhetoric back a little.
They had to tone for that Jaguar commercial that they did.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
But at the time that was all taken really seriously. It was a real like Soviet mentality.
Oh, yeah.
Around Seattle, and you know. I mean, what was Sunny Day Real Estate refused to do any interviews? I don't know if you
I was a huge Sunny Day fan.
But they wouldn't
fan,
do any
But I didn't
interviews.
Know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were like, we won't do any interviews. So what do you think about that? Like,
suck on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Press.
Fuck you, world.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And there was a ton of that type of stuff.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And I mean, I still see residue of it. Young musicians, you know.
It's definitely come up and, still around.
Yeah.
It is definitely still around.
Guys want to talk to me about their careers, and I'm like, sure, okay, so what are you doing? And they're like, well, I mean, really want to just get on some good tours and put out some records. And I'm like, oh, yeah? Get on some good tours, huh? Yeah, well, you know, like with Arcade Fire maybe or with Death Cab. I'm like, yeah, you and 50,000 other bands, smart guy.
Yeah, totally.
Like,
totally.
What are you going to do now?
Like, you need at least 50 likes on your Facebook page for that to happen.
Get a better plan than that you're going to open for the Arcade Fire, because that's not going to happen for you.
Right, right. So have you, going through that, and then eventually hooking up with Sean Nelson and doing what would become the first Long Winters album.
Right.
Right. Are you jaded at all from that experience?
Well,
I know that's a big leap, too, from what we were talking about to where I'm going. But.
And that's a good question. It really is, because there's a certain amount of cynicism that comes in to being in business,
mm-hmm.
right? And being in the music business is being in business.
Right.
And it's a thing that every young musician wants to deny.
Yeah.
Every single young musician wants to say, or does say, I don't want to be in business, I want to make music. And
mm-hmm.
if my music is good, I won't have to be in business. And that's never true.
That's never true.
You're
going to have to enter that at some point.
You're going into business.
Right.
And if you put a band together, and especially if you're a band leader, you're a businessman, and you'd better be one.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are one, even if you're not one, even if you pretend you're not one, a certain amount of cynicism creeps in, because you're dealing with other human beings, and you're talking about money, and you're talking about rank, you know?
Right.
And that's
right.
a thing that no one in the music business wants to speak about openly, which is that it's all about rank. I mean, every single person with an iTunes folder is busy ranking their bands.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
With 1 through 5 stars. And if you're on a show with 3 other bands, you each have an idea of what your ranking is on that bill and in the world, in your town, in the world. And that's very cynical making over time.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're looking at people and people bring their sense of entitlement to the game. And
yeah. But what you're saying there, too, I mean, that stuff is more recent. Like, you know, the iTunes and Facebook and MySpace and Bandcamp and, you know, all the new resources out there for bands and, you know, rating systems and stuff like that.
It's just putting a face to a thing that's always been true.
Who
do you like better, totally. The Beatles or the Stones?
Yeah.
And it's just a way we think about art. This art is better than that art.
Right.
And
now we've given it a medium, though, too, for smaller bands to, like, get good reviews, you know, from people that are just checking it out, and then get really bad ones as well.
Right.
Which can be soul-crushing.
Yeah, that didn't used to happen the way it does now. That's
right,
true.
Right.
But, you know, your soul has to be ready to be crushed, I'm afraid.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Or you have to have thick skin, or you have to do what the really smart thing, which is don't read the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
But that whole.
But if you're an avid tweeter,
well, you can tweet without reading reviews of your record. Although I haven't been able to. but in answer to your question, I try very hard to be the right amount of jaded.
Mm-hmm.
So that it doesn't, it's not a jadedness that prohibits me from enjoying new things or from seeing new things as good.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of guys my age, my generation of musician, who look at the Fleet Foxes, the Head and the Heart, the neo-folk, the Bon Iver movement, mm-hmm. of folk music, and they just can't handle it. You know,
right,
they've seen enough rock and roll go by, and they just don't buy it, you know?
Right.
And unfortunately, their cynicism is getting in the way of them enjoying good music, which is what that stuff is at its best.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say too, right there, are they just, you know, is it jealousy that it didn't happen or didn't seem to happen that big and that quick for them? You know,
well, sure.
When they were in that position, and yeah.
And know. that's always true. I mean, there's
right,
always,
right.
I mean, when the Decemberists came out.
This is where I was going.
Every single person in the music business that I knew
said,
well, that won't last.
Right.
And the Long Winters went on tour with the Decemberists a couple of different times.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on each other's records, and we became kind of music business bros and just like Northwest band bros.
Right, right.
And so for whatever reason, people knew that about me and they would seek me out at parties to tell me that the Decemberists they were a fad and nobody was going to keep buying this.
Yeah, yeah.
And 2, 3, 4, 5 records in and the Decemberists are part of, you know, American music culture.
Yeah.
And there are still people who want to come up to me and say, like, why are they buying this shtick?
Yeah.
And I've said the same thing from the very beginning, which is listen to the songwriting. It's great. You know, the musicianship is great and the songwriting is great. And if there's an element of theatricality or of kitsch to it that is putting you off,
right,
then you're not, then what it's doing is getting in the way of you like appreciating the melodies and the craftsmanship of the stuff. And that's what, the reason that their new record debuted at number one is that the vast majority of music listeners aren't dissecting what they listen to so carefully.
Right. Right.
And so they're capable.
And it sounds good to their ears.
Yeah. And it's got a hook, which is the thing we're all trying to do.
Right.
And if it has a hook and it survives multiple listenings, then there it is. You have to give it up for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's take another break here.
Mm.
And we're going to play something else from the Long Winters, from the album When I Pretend to Fall, off of Barsook Records. You can get this song on the Long Winters website at longwinters.com. Just go up to the header there and press the MP3 tab, and you'll find a bunch of songs here that you can just download for free, which is really cool.
Yeah, although you can also buy them on iTunes.
And buy them. Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Cheap kids.
And rate it. With 5 stars.
Go steal 4 quarters out of your mom's dresser and pay for the damn song.
Fucking assholes.
But you can also listen to it for free because that's how it rolls. That's how we roll.
That's right. That's right. So this is Blue Diamonds by the Long Winters, and we will be back with more from John Roderick and his experience. And maybe tell us a story about your tooth.
Oh, all right.
Okay. Yeah. Done. All right. We'll be back in a moment.
You laugh at what the LA Times says about us, but delight at my first try at being sly. Finish the third page, time for a break. You make a gang sign framing your face. Time for the hard life, time to get dressed. Good luck, God bless. Like this is happening in tree time. I stand up and toast the TV for getting it right. God willing, and the creek don't rise. I've got $2,000 and a bullseye between my eyes. These chickens are fish in a barrel, and the tall one is gonna be for sale.
Blue Diamonds from the album When I Pretend to Fall by the Long Winters. Mr. John Roderick is still joining me, which is absolutely amazing.
I'm still here.
Because he hasn't succumbed to the roofies that I put in his orange juice yet, so that's pretty amazing.
Incredibly high tolerance for drugs.
Must be all those hobos that were trying to drug you up.
And all
created
the...
a tolerance.
All the subsequent years of doing drugs.
That too. That too. So, when we left, we were talking a little bit about your experience and your level of jadedness with being in the industry. And I remember reading do you still write for the weekly? Seattle Weekly?
I do. I've just taken a little hiatus. Because I had a kid, so I have
right.
I didn't have the power to do late night column writing. But
yeah,
I'm I'm excited to get back doing it.
Yeah, are you gonna start that again?
I think really soon. Yeah. Excellent. In fact, I have a column in the Bumbershoot issue.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Wonderful. Well, I was reading a column that you did a long. God, it's got to be at least 6 years ago, where you were writing about the Decemberists.
Mm-hmm.
And your experience, I believe, and tell me if I'm wrong on this too. What the column was, or what you said in the column was that you were kind of peeved that the Decemberists all of a sudden had this this new following, mm-hmm. and your band didn't.
Right. Well, that's
was
happened.
There some truth to that, or was that kind of tongue in cheek?
No, absolutely true. That's happened multiple times in my career. You know, the first band that I watched kind of streak away was Death Cab for Cutie. When Death Cab was just starting out, they played shows with my band at the time, the Western State Hurricanes, and we played many, many, many shows together. We went on one of our earliest tours, either band's earliest tour together, where we were playing in Sacramento for 20 people combined, you know, before Death Cab's first record came out. And it was always true of those guys, even when they were just 21, 22-year-old guys.
Right.
That you could just look at them and say, like,
they're going to do something.
Yeah, I mean, if the world doesn't embrace this band, then it's the world's problem. You know, these guys are great songwriters and great musicians from the very get-go. So watching them get successful wasn't hard for me, because it was very natural. Like, go, you guys, go do it.
Take it.
What happened with the Decemberists was that their first record and the Long Winter's first record came out at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And you guys toured together. We toured together, and we would go to each other's shows. So we would play in Portland, and the Decemberists would come. And then they would play in Seattle, and we would, you know, the Long Winter's would go. And we were, like, very supportive of each other.
Uh-huh.
And also, like, friendly rivalry, because we were both writing what I think the popular press would call articulate music, literary music.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were on tour with them when they first broke big.
Mm-hmm.
So we started the tour and played in Salt Lake City, and nobody came. And by the end of the tour in L.A., it was a sold-out show with a line around the block at a huge theater, and they were a massive American band.
Uh-huh.
So watching that happen, and that's very hard on a band when it happens, you know, and particularly a band where there's a charismatic front person. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on you. During that tour, they were still sleeping two to a bed, four to a room at, you know, La Quinta Inns.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they were playing massive shows by the end of it, and they just hadn't caught up to the scale that they were going to end up being.
Yeah.
But from my standpoint at that time, I was doing what you would naturally do, which is saying, well, why is the world not turning its attention to me the same way? I mean, my songs are, I think, as good and in some cases better, and here I am with a great show and a great band, and what's the malfunction?
Yeah, yeah.
But in the intervening years between 2000, so that happened in 2004. In the intervening years, I've watched Band of Horses do that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was at I think I was at Band of Horses' first show when they were still called Horses, and it was two guys, and it was in the green room of the Showbox.
Right.
Capacity 15.
Right.
And knew those guys, and have Ben Bridwell's demo that he gave me, where he has all those songs written and no lyrics yet.
Yeah.
So he's just humming.
Yeah.
And then they became a massive band. And watching that happen to the Fleet Foxes, and watching that happen to so many bands who...
And a lot of bands here that you've worked with, right?
And like as people. And we consider each other peers. We are part of the same music community.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point, it's very easy for somebody in my position to say either fuck the world,
right, right,
because they don't understand my genius, or maybe I suck because all these guys that I've worked with have become famous and I'm still sort of laboring in the trenches.
Right, right.
But the actual perspective is that every year there are 8,000 new albums and only 100 of them sell more than 5,000 copies.
Right, right. And including a band that you could see as being extremely popular.
Oh,
they may not be selling that much albums.
There are incredible bands on a daily basis that put out records and nobody ever hears, and they disappear, or they people start to talk about them and they break up, or they work for 10 years and nobody ever cares.
Right,
know?
Right.
It isn't as Travis Morrison of the Dismemberment Plan said to me one time over dinner when I was bitching about my fate. And this was right before his album Travistan came out and he got a 0.0 on Pitchfork.
Ugh.
But he said to me, even then, before he learned that hard lesson, he said, John, there's no earning it. You don't earn success in the music business.
Yeah.
You do everything and sometimes it doesn't work. And sometimes the asshole gets famous,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
who didn't work at all. And in the case of all these bands that I've been fortunate enough to play shows with, they all deserve it, and I admire them all. And what had to happen for me was the reality check of understanding that I have been successful.
Mm-hmm.
I've been tremendously successful. I've made a living at music, and I think I'm pretty well regarded as an artist.
Well, and that's what I was going to say too. Like, what? So obviously, you've come to that realization now.
Had to, yeah.
Yeah, that you, because I view you personally, I view your music kind of, for lack of a better term, the standing of the Long Winters, especially here in the Seattle area, is extremely well respected. You're a very well-known person. You have a very well-known name. You're ending up, you're making all these friends and in these amazing bands and playing and being, you know, guest appearances on albums and all these things. Like, do you measure that as success?
Well, you have to.
I mean,
a lot.
But how long did it take you to do that and to realize that?
Well, it's an ongoing process.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about, there are so many instructive stories in the music world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ones that I always kind of turn to is John Fogerty and Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Mm-hmm.
Creedence is one of the all-time great bands. I would argue that Creedence was more influential on the Seattle music scene than even Neil Young, who became kind of the patron saint of grunge. I would say the music had owed more to Creedence than it did even to Neil Young.
But you're saying like back in the 90s or now?
Back in the 90s and now. I mean, okay. I would
say, I would agree with you if you were saying now with all the, definitely with all the vocal harmonies and everything.
But
like
if you think
like,
about, if you think about the song structure and the pure like intent,
right,
of Creedence, and compare that to Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
And then you,
I guess I could see that if we're talking about Cosmos Factory, like.
But in any case,
that was some lo-fi stuff.
You know, Creedence put out a string of incredible records.
Right,
they were
right.
They were the biggest band in the world in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the line, John Fogerty felt like he was getting ripped off by the music company, and he wasn't getting along with his brother who was in the band with him and the other two dudes. And he lost sight of the deal,
mm-hmm,
and got into a protracted feud with his own band and with the music business in general that lasts to this day.
Right.
He didn't put out another record until 1985 or 1986 because he refused to write music under the conditions of this music contract that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I mean, all the members of Creedence Clearwater Revival are still alive, and the other guys are out in a band called Creedence Clearwater Revisited. And John Fogerty is sitting somewhere on a couch, yeah, right, with a television remote in his hand.
Just being super pissed.
Yeah. And yeah, so if you look at John Fogerty, you think, like, I love this man's music. I love, and in a way, you couldn't be a bigger superstar than he was in his time.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows the music he would have made if he had managed to get his head right about what it all boils down to, you know, which
right,
is just
right,
like, you got one shot at this and yeah, you're going to be bitter, then you're not doing yourself any favors.
Yeah.
So in my own case, you know, I definitely have friends that like show up for their concerts in a helicopter.
Yeah.
And
which is awesome.
And step out on stage wrapped in the American flag while 80,000 people scream at the top of their lungs.
Yeah.
And then there's me, who's like, you know, a locally well-known guy or whatever it was that you said. And it is a daily process of saying thank you to the universe for what I have. And,
yeah, yeah.
And aspiring, continuing to aspire to make things that are good,
mm-hmm,
and hope that finds an audience.
Yeah.
I mean, the my experience of the last year has been very unusual in that I've become kind of mobbed up with this nerd underground.
Yes.
It's not an underground.
Woodstock.
Even. Woodstock, the Jonathan Coulton Cruise.
Right.
The guys from Mythbusters.
I wanted to ask you about that cruise too,
because yeah,
I was looking at your pictures online,
mm-hmm,
and I didn't even know what that was.
Well, nobody does outside of the confines of this.
Can we even talk about
universe?
This?
I think we can.
Okay,
it's on the internet.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be hard to find.
No, I thought it was all myth. Yeah,
but it's a universe of people that we think of that certainly 15 years ago we would have just said, well, those are nerds.
Mm-hmm.
They play Dungeons and Dragons, and they like fantasy novels, and they like computer games, and they tend to be crafty, and they tend to work in tech jobs.
Yeah.
And maybe they would wear like a Punisher T-shirt to work. I think if you're getting the picture. But these people kind of liberated themselves,
right,
somewhere
yeah,
along the line.
Yeah,
from,
totally. Well, they got older.
Well, they got older, and
we grew up.
And what happened
you
was,
I say we.
I do notice that. What happened was, because of the tech explosion, like
yeah,
what had formerly been the nerds who were back in the engineering suite, a lot of them became millionaires.
Right.
And
right,
they didn't have to apologize for being a nerd anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Allen is the biggest nerd that ever walked the face of the earth, and he's the fourth richest man in the world.
Yeah.
So nerds kind of came out of the closet, and they weren't really interested in regular culture. They had their culture that they
yeah,
liked.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there are a few musicians and comedians and culture people who just full on were nerds themselves and
then ended up being embraced by that
right,
by that culture.
Catered to this culture.
Right.
And
right,
were embraced by it. And I think Mythbusters, the television show, is a classic example.
Love that show.
Here's these guys that are nerds. And what did they do? They figured out a way to get paid to blow stuff up.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happened? It became the biggest show on the Discovery Channel.
Yeah.
And those guys didn't become... they don't dress like Liberace now and
no,
live in a...
Jamie Hyneman wears a fucking beret.
Yeah, and they just do what they like, you know? So
yeah,
anyway, the cruise and the Woodstock are these kind of cultural events where some of the shining lights of that nerd culture
mm-hmm,
get to perform for an audience that is entirely nerd
right,
based.
Yeah.
And
Will Wheaton being a seminal figure.
Will Wheaton is
at both of those,
is,
right?
Is a very important man in Nerdland.
Yeah,
he
yeah,
was not only on Star Trek and Stand By Me, but early blogger.
Yeah,
and avid Dungeons and Dragons player, and he wears a utilikilt, like he's not playing. Will Wheaton.
Yeah,
but for whatever reason,
And he's a very accomplished writer, too,
And he's a gentle man.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, I was embraced by this group, and part of it was through my friendship with John Hodgman and Jonathan Colton.
Okay.
And part of it was just kind of a natural affinity. Like, I write songs with complete sentences and multisyllabic words.
Yeah.
And there's an audience for that.
Yeah.
But one of the songs that I wrote several years ago was about the space shuttle crash.
Mm-hmm.
And it had always been one of the big songs in our set.
What song?
It's called The Commander Thinks Aloud.
Oh, okay.
It was on our EP, which is the Ultimatum EP, but it became kind of one of our signature tunes.
Right.
And it's a long song, and it doesn't have any guitars on it. It's all synthesizers crashing into each other.
Right.
And it's about, you know, it's about the space shuttle Columbia.
Yeah. By the way, is that your car?
I don't think so. No, it's somebody else's car.
Okay.
Some jerk down the street. You do live one block off of Aurora. I was surprised weren't.
Well, that's a running a running joke on this show is that we're high above Aurora Avenue, looking down on all the prostitutes.
It wasn't that many years ago when it was actually like a Michael Jackson video out here on these streets.
Yeah, it is some nights actually. Yeah.
Oh, but anyway, so I started playing these nerd events, and I was invited there because it was kind of a natural fit. But
right.
This particular song, Commander Thinks Aloud, the first time I played it for a group for 1,200 pure nerds.
Yeah.
I got done with the song and it was dead silent in the auditorium for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 seconds.
Uh-huh.
Which had never happened to me as a performer.
Yeah.
And I found out later it was because most of the people in the room were crying.
Really?
Which had really never happened to me as a performer.
Yeah.
And people lined up afterwards to come talk to me, and I had multiple people come up and say, you know, I work at NASA, and one of my jobs was to go pick up the wreckage of the space shuttle.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that song really... They didn't have to say that song resonated with me.
It
was just like,
you got it.
And yeah. so it was in some ways a perfect storm where maybe if you're a nerd like that and you have Elizabethan proclivities, you've heard of the Decembrists.
Yeah.
I
would say you'd probably heard of the Long Winters as well.
Perhaps, but there were a lot of people in this situation where their exposure to that song was completely out of the blue and like a singular moment of
emotion.
Of emotional connection with a group of people who typically you wouldn't call them people that
connect that way to
music. Are having an emotional connection with the art that they love.
Right.
And I don't mean that to be disparaging, but like...
No.
They tend to like music that is like comedy songs about Star Wars. You know what I mean? Like they're not... They were just as unprepared to have something reach them at their core. And this is a song about, obviously about a spaceship crash, but about a real one.
Right.
You know, where some of the people in the audience had like knew the people.
Yeah.
So that solidified my standing with them, and I think in a lot of ways solidified their standing with me.
Uh-huh.
I stopped talking about them. I mean, you should have heard the way I used to talk about them, but I stopped feeling like, oh my God, a bunch of Dungeons and Dragons playing seventh graders who are now 40.
Yeah.
I started to feel, I started to go down to the game room where they were all playing Settlers of Catan or doing jigsaw puzzles or whatever.
Right.
Like kind of hanging out with them and like, oh, so how does this game work? I'd come full circle. Now I'm collecting comic books again. I'm playing World of Warcraft.
Are you?
No.
You had me. Yeah.
Not playing World of Warcraft. But I will sit and watch people play World of Warcraft, and I won't even be stoned.
Yeah. That is a feat, man. That is a feat. Well, I got to say, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you, John. And I would love in the future if you would come back on maybe at some later date.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And play some songs for us as well. yeah, this is it's just been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
I'm glad. Thank you for inviting me. I'm sorry that I was such a bear to get on the horn.
You know, it's just... I guess it's you know, you're kind of a dick.
Yeah, well, you figured it out. You all you needed to do was tweet me, and you tweeted me today. And
I
then,
finally did it.
What happened? I was there within an hour.
I couldn't think of something that would be under 140 characters because I always like to put dot 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 after everything. So, yeah. But thank you so much. So where can we find? Why don't we plug your wares here really quick?
Right. Well, all of our albums are available on iTunes, and I highly suggest that all of your listeners go buy the entire catalog right now.
Yes, please do.
Rate it all with 5 stars and buy it for your friends too. Buy multiple iTunes copies. But you can also find our records in the vinyl form from Barsook Records.
Yeah.
And the vinyl records have, there are some extra tracks on there and they're very beautiful. They're talismanic artifacts. You want those if you have a record player.
Yeah, or if you're a music nerd.
Right, if you're a nerd.
Yeah.
Barsook also has all the T-shirts and stuff.
What do you guys got coming up? You guys are going to be playing City Arts?
Yeah, we've got some shows. I'm doing the Joco Cruise again in February, and you should buy tickets to that if you have an extra $2,000.
Matter of fact, I do.
You should go. It's a blast. We go down through the Caribbean.
Sounds like so much fun.
It's nuts. A bunch of people in Punisher T-shirts standing on the beach in Bermuda.
That is awesome.
It's a hilarious thing to see.
Just like the whitest people in the Caribbean.
Yeah. Well, people of any race, who all of whom universally have not seen the sun.
Right.
So let's see. I'm doing that, and then we have this new record that I've been trying to build.
Yeah.
And
when can we expect to see that coming out?
Well, I've made promises about when that record's coming out before, on the radio before, on the podcasts before. And all those promises have, like, lost me credibility with all my many fans who say, you promised in 2008 that the record would be done in 4 months.
Right.
Yeah. But a lot of things have happened to me in the last couple of years, and so I'm beavering away at it.
Yeah, and you're going with the flow, man. You're a dad, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
You guys are going to be getting the band back together, yep. Man, to play City Arts Festival.
City Arts Festival on October 20th.
Excellent.
At the Showbox Theater.
I am going to be there.
Yeah.
I am going to be there because I've seen you play live. I haven't seen the whole band play live.
Well,
I'm looking forward to that.
It's going
to
be a spectacular experience because right now I don't know who's in the band.
Okay.
So I've got a couple of months to figure that out and get them up to snuff, but I know a lot of really good musicians.
I will play the triangle for you, sir.
All right. We have some triangle parts.
Excellent.
I'll have to dig those out.
And what about this Nirvana thing that's coming up, too?
Oh, and then there's a bunch of Seattle musicians are covering the Nirvana record, Nevermind, all the way through at the EMP on September 20th, and that's a thing that...
September.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. I was thinking it was on Saturday.
If you want tickets to that, you had better get them, though, because they're selling fast.
Totally.
And Chris Novoselic is going to be there, and it's going to be a big...
Nice.
It's going to be a big event.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, John, for coming out. And this has been a great conversation, man.
Good, I enjoy it. Thank you for inviting me.
We hit hobos.
Hobos.
We talked about being jaded.
Jaded.
and then we talked about nerds.
Yeah, that's right.
Which are the hobos of the future?
What else could we have talked about? We didn't. You know what?
Nothing at
all. Like nerds, we never talked about girls once.
That's right.
We didn't, except for our little baby girls. We didn't mention any.
That's right.
Women at all in this podcast. Yeah. So, in that sense, it will fit right in with the wall of podcasts.
Thanks. All right, man. Thank you so much.
You bet.
And thank all of you for listening to the Air Raid podcast. And remember, you can go onto iTunes, rate us,
Tell us what you think. Send me your emails, aaron@air-ray.net, or visit the greatnoisebeam.com site. That's NOIZBEAM.com. Some great, great shows up on there, including this one, the Air Raid podcast. And you can get all your streaming needs from there. Also, you know, remember to give us a thumbs up on Stitcher and check out our new sponsor, the American Brewing Company, up there in Edmonds, Washington. They've got some fantastic beers, and I really urge you guys to check that out. So we're going to close out the show today with the song Pushover by The Long Winters. We've got some great, great guests coming up for the next episodes. So we hope that you all tune in for those. But until then, have a great week. That isn't sly, or so you say. Don't toast the day before the twilight. For you, I'm a pushover. I would, I would. I just want you to say, come on, wish me luck, wish me luck. Like a deed to the world without the talk as you wait.